Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Matthew Rothschild, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, who assesses the outcome of the 2018 midterm election and prospects for progressive movements challenging President Trump's extremist agenda. Sayu Bajwani, founder of the group New American Leaders, who talks about her book titled People Like Us, The New Wave of Candidates, Knocking at Democracy's Door, an examination of how immigrants are changing America's political landscape. And the voices of local Connecticut activists who mobilized to protect immigrant rights, countering President Trump's message of hate and fear in the closing days of the midterm election campaign. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
3 years ago, Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko asked Facebook to stop Russia's use of it to promote fake news about the conflict in Ukraine. The PBS Frontline program reports that Ukraine was the proving ground for Russian attempts to employ social media strategies to influence domestic politics of rival nations. Similar tactics were used during the 2016 U.S. presidential election and in other countries, including the Philippines and Myanmar. Former Facebook employees were aware of Russia's cyber warfare in the Ukraine, but top company executives ignored the warnings. Across the globe, Facebook had been viewed as a force for change and reform, including during the 2011 Arab Spring and the 2014 Maidan Revolution in the Ukraine, which deposed a regime with close ties to the Kremlin. Critics have accused Facebook of turning a blind eye to their platforms being used as a megaphone by Buddhist nationalist leaders in Myanmar who had called for the murder and expulsion of the Muslim Rohingya minority. In March, the United Nations declared that Facebook had a determining role in the genocide there. In reacting to the criticism, Facebook has moved to censor what it views as extremist content, including Alex Jones' InfoWars site in the US. But this precedent has also recently been used to remove credible progressive news sites as well, prompting Rolling Stone magazine's Matt Taibbi to write, "The endgame here couldn't be clearer. This is how authoritarian marriages begin, and people should be very worried." Top prosecutors in South Florida, including Miami-Dade State Attorney Catherine Fernandez Rundle, are calling on the Florida Supreme Court to overturn an expanded version of the notorious Stand Your Ground gun law that has been used as a defense in high-profile murder cases. In court papers, the League of Prosecutors, a Miami group of current and former local state's attorneys, says that the revamped law forces prosecutors to try self-defense cases before a judge, not a jury. The Stand Your Ground gun law, first passed in 2005 with the strong backing of the National Rifle Association, was used successfully by defense attorneys in the murder of unarmed teenager Trayvon Martin, who was shot and killed by gunman George Zimmerman. According to the Miami Herald, a newly expanded version of the Stand Your Ground law played a role in how the shooting death of Marques McLaughlin in Clearwater, Florida, was handled. The victim was shot in a dispute over a parking space. However, the local sheriff did not immediately arrest the shooter, Michael Drezka, citing the expanded Stand Your Ground law, although prosecutors later charged Drezka with manslaughter. For years, the burden of proof in self-defense cases fell on the defendant. Now, under the new Stand Your Ground law, the responsibility rests with prosecutors to disprove a defendant's claim of self-defense. Activists in New York and California converged last winter to expose and protest the housing abuses of financial giant Blackstone Group, run by billionaire Stephen Schwarzman, an ally of Donald Trump. Blackstone is worth over $400 billion. According to the American Prospect, companies owned by Blackstone employ over 450,000 people and manage nearly 300,000 residential housing units. Blackstone also owns mortgage and installment loan companies. private equity investors operate by leveraging capital from pension funds and insurance companies in order to buy companies and then to extract profits, often by loading those companies with debt and by reducing wages and benefits for workers and other stakeholders. With its massive size, Blackstone has become a lightning rod for housing, community and labour activists regarding its exploitative housing and lending practices, its labour disputes, crony capitalism and environmental destruction. In Greater New York, Make the Road called on Blackstone to bar its affiliates, including Finance for America and Bayview Asset Management, from foreclosing on properties in hurricane-ravaged regions, including Puerto Rico, Florida and Texas. Activists in New Jersey pressured the state pension fund to lean on Blackstone to halt foreclosures in Puerto Rico, which it did until a self-imposed moratorium on foreclosures expired in September. The extreme concentration of economic ownership and power in 21st century America is creating more opportunities for disparate groups to ally against common adversaries and to pressure them for broad concessions on issues of social justice. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
In what many commentators and political observers have declared the most important midterm election in recent U.S. history, Democrats won control of the House of Representatives and broke the Republican Party's monopoly on federal political power. The campaign, unlike any other in decades, was characterized by President Trump's naked appeal for support for his Republican Party based on white identity politics, the demonization and denigration of immigrants, Muslims, and people of color. While that appeal helped Trump win the presidency in 2016 through the Electoral College, he lost the popular vote to Hillary Clinton by some 3 million ballots. In their victory on November 6, voters supporting Democratic candidates had to overcome GOP-engineered voter suppression tactics, massive voter purges, and partisan gerrymandering of congressional district maps. Your reporter spoke with Matthew Rothschild, executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, and former editor and publisher of the Progressive magazine. Here he assesses how the outcome of the 2018 midterm election can change the direction of the nation, prospects for progressive movements challenging President Trump's extremist agenda, and concerns about the next 2 years under a Trump presidency.
The Democrats can act as a check against any reactionary laws that Trump is trying to pass. So that's essentially the House would have veto power. And equally important, the Democrats in the House can have their own investigations. They can have subpoena power. They can start impeachment hearings, which they ought to. They have an obligation to because of the terrible violations of the Constitution and of our very democracy that Trump is committing. And so that's what they should do. They should start hearings right away, send out, you know, hundreds of subpoenas and use the power that they have. I fear that some of the moderate leadership in the party is going to be squeamish and say, well, we got to play to the middle here. We don't want to seem like obstructionists or whatever. They have an obligation, if they win, to pursue these Trump scandals and to start impeachment hearings pronto. So I hope they do that.
Matthew, what can you say about some of the new crop of candidates we've seen emerge? Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is kind of the poster child for this year's progressive candidates with different backgrounds than the usual suspects who step up, who run for office, who have deep pockets and a lot of links to wealthy folks. Do you find some hope in some of the new candidates that have stepped up, including a record number of women who for the first time are running for office?
Yes, young people, women, people of color, LGBT folks. It's very exciting to see this new generation and new stripe of leader among the Democrats. And that does indeed give me hope. And also the fact that, you know, we have openly socialists running. I mean, Bernie Sanders has inspired so many people to, you know, use the S word and say that they're socialists. And that's comforting, too. So I think, you know, the demographics are with the progressive movement in this country if we can get through this Trump era and still have a democracy to call our own. That's the real cutting question right now.
What's your assessment of progressive movements that have emerged since the Trump inauguration in 2017, the resistance movements?
You know, this is the most hope, because the resistance to Trump started on day one, or day two, if you want, with the Women's March, and it's continued all the way through with the great rallies for immigration rights, for immigrant rights, the rallies against climate change, the scientists marching, the Me Too movement, Black Lives Matter movement. There is a lot going on at the grassroots. People are stirring in ways that they haven't stirred before. They're stirring on campuses, too. So civil society is standing up. That's the good news. It's standing up with the people, and it's actually standing up with some of the media, which is good. And our institutions are standing up, by and large, except for the Republican Party, which is collapsing on its knees in front of Donald Trump, which is a disgusting sight to see.
What are the major threats you see from the Trump White House over the next couple of years?
Well, let me go to the direst one. And the direst one is that he declares martial law. And that, don't think I'm just being hyperbolic here. It's possible, if the United States is ever attacked again, not even at the scale of 9/11, maybe one-tenth of 9/11, that he could declare martial law. Or he could, if he decides to fire Mueller and pardon all his friends, then there would be a lot of protests in the street, I hope. But also then the Trump supporters and the white supremacists might incite some violence. And if there's a lot of violence in the street, Trump again could declare martial law. And who's going to stop him? You know, the old comment that Stalin made when he was told that the Pope didn't like the way he was treating Catholics. He said, how many divisions does the Pope have? Well, how many divisions does the House of Representatives have, or the Senate have, or the U.S. Supreme Court have? Trump's got a lot of divisions.
That was Matthew Rothschild, executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign and former editor and publisher of the Progressive magazine. For more analysis and commentary on the outcome of the 2018 midterm election, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In an era when the Republican Party has resorted to a brazen election campaign message scapegoating immigrants and people of color for America's economic problems, crime, and uncertain future, there are hopeful signs that an increasing number of Americans of diverse ethnicities and heritage are stepping up to run for public office. Although elected officials in local, state, and federal office remain overwhelmingly white, there's a growing consciousness among America's minority communities that in order to have a seat at the table and a voice in making critical decisions that affect their lives, they can choose to engage as political activists and candidates in the electoral system. The 2018 midterm elections are likely to be historic for a number of reasons, including the record number of women, immigrant, and first-generation candidates who've chosen to run for office. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez stunned both political parties when she won her Democratic primary against 10-term incumbent Joe Crowley in New York's 14th congressional district. Rashida Tlaib of Michigan and Ilhan Omar of Minnesota could both become the nation's first Muslim women to be elected to Congress. Your reporter spoke with Sayu Bajwani, founder and president of New American Leaders, the only national organization focused on preparing immigrant and first-generation citizens to run for public office. Here she talks about her new book titled People Like Us, The New Wave of Candidates Knocking at Democracy's Door, an examination of how immigrants are changing America's political landscape.
Yeah, we have about 50 people that New American Leaders has trained over the last couple of years on the ballot in places like Arizona and Michigan and New York, California. And that momentum that has led to those 50 is not just our work, but of course this political moment. What New American Leaders does is recruit and train immigrant leaders to learn how to run for political office and to encourage them to run as they are, with their stories front and center, using their stories and their commitment to their communities to expand the electorate by inviting new and what we call low efficacy voters who often get ignored by traditional candidates and frankly by the political parties, inviting them to participate in the campaign. And so, you know, as much as, you know, one aspect of our work is about training people to run for office, the underlying goal is to expand the Democracy Party so that more people feel like they can be part of it.
So could you run through some of the institutional obstacles that stand in the way of people from diverse backgrounds, whether it be race or ethnicity or language? What are some of the things that are real difficulties that need to be overcome for these folks to come forward and run for office?
Some of the barriers are societal, if you will, or part of the system. And one of those, of course, that we hear often about is incumbent advantage, that it's very hard to challenge someone who's been in office for a long time and to really help run a competitive campaign against them. You need to get the support of other party leaders or endorsing institutions, and those folks tend to want to stick with the devil they know, right? So even if the incumbent's not all that good, there's a tendency to keep endorsing him or her at the expense of a newcomer. And of course, we want a democracy where there are more open elections and more people challenging incumbents, but that's really hard for newcomers to do. Another, I think, big challenge that newcomers face is the issue of money, and I'm sure that your listeners hear that quite a bit about the cost of a campaign. But also our system has not really been set up to work for modern America. So we had a time when founding fathers could decide that government worked well enough if a few people went to the state capitol for a certain period of the year and made the laws. But in today's America, you know, we want our legislators to be representing us year-round. We want them to be fighting for us year-round. But the salaries that we pay state legislators are anywhere from $17,000 to $24,000 for jobs that are considered part-time. And how that becomes an issue is that if I am someone who's trying to raise a family, pay off student debt, I really can't afford to be a legislator. So even if I could run a great campaign, it's hard for me to sustain my family and engage in public service in a meaningful way if I can't pay my bills. And so that incumbent advantage and the salary structure in state legislatures in particular are a couple of the obstacles that people face.
Sayu, what can you say about some of the newer candidates that have emerged since you wrote the book? Certainly one of the most prominent candidates from New York City, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who defeated a very powerful Democrat, Joe Crowley, in New York City, who was, I think, third in line for the House speakership among Democrats. But there are many others that we don't hear a lot about. What's your general sense of how many people have stepped up and run this year and are unexpectedly running very strong candidacies?
Our organization tracked the number of foreign-born candidates, and there were nearly 200 in the primaries, and about 100 of them are headed into the general, and that's at all levels, you know, from Congress to school board. I would be spoiled for choice if I was writing the book now. There's so many more people. But as it relates to Alexandria and others, you know, even Ilhan's congressional race or Rashida's congressional race in Michigan, I think what we're seeing is a very specific set of strategies. One is to, you know, candidates who are running authentically, running by telling their story and owning who they are, whatever that might be, not trying to fit some sort of traditional candidate mold. The second is talking to voters, and especially the types of voters that tend to get ignored, people who are newly registered citizens, people who are not registered, people who are not used to going to vote in every single election. I think those two things are really, really important. And we've seen that in Alexandria's campaign. It's at the core of what we teach at New American Leaders. You know, I say this in my book, that we have this political quandary that we're in because the parties are churning out the usual type of candidates, and voters are saying, we don't want the usual type of candidate. We want someone who we can trust to fight for us. And I think that's what we've seen work over and over again this election cycle. We all are in this together, whether we like it or not. And it will, I think, work much better if we all accept that we have a shared goal for our country and for ourselves and our families.
That was Sayu Bajwani, author of the book People Like Us, The New Wave of Candidates Knocking at Democracy's Door. Learn more about how immigrants are changing America's political landscape by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the midst of a bitter midterm election campaign, where President Trump and members of his Republican Party pulled out all the stops to demonize immigrants, individuals and groups across the U.S. organized local actions to counter the right-wing message of hate and fear. On October 21st, about 200 supporters of immigrants' rights joined a 78-year-old man on a two-mile walk around Hartford, Connecticut, to press for freedom for an Ecuadorian immigrant in sanctuary for almost a year, as well as immigrants' rights generally. Al Dornan began walking a daily two-mile loop from his house in a nearby town last January, despite severe back problems and pain. Then several groups joined forces with Dornan to bring out walkers from throughout Connecticut. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was there and brings us excerpts of speeches made during the action. We hear first from Jose Diaz, a young Mexican immigrant and dreamer, followed by Al Dornan's concluding remarks.
So my name is Jose Diaz, and as I was over there in the beginning, thinking of what I was going to say, getting cold, as all of you are, I actually thought about the moment when I was crossing the border and how I had to swim the river. And as soon as I went inside, my whole body went numb of how cold the water was. When I got to the other side, I found out that we didn't have any change of clothes, and I was gonna have to continue to walk all night in wet clothes while it was cold. So I got my work permit for DACA. I just renewed it, so I got it. And I wanted to speak about this right here. Undocumented, unafraid, unapologetic. Because even though I have DACA, that doesn't mean that I'm safe. That doesn't mean that I have documents. That just means that I'm able to be here for only 2 years and work. Unafraid. I have been afraid every day. And you know what makes me unafraid? My friends, my family, the people I love, all of you here today, making me not feel alone. Unapologetic. I'm not perfect. No one is. But I don't have to give explanations of why I'm even here, because my family was looking after me. They wanted a better future for me. And if it wasn't for them, to be honest, I'd probably be back in Mexico, not having an education. I would probably have joined a gang, like some of the friends that I had there, and I actually talked to, and some are actually dead. So comparing what I'm going through right now and the uncertainty, I prefer this rather than that. But I know if I go back, I don't know what's gonna happen. I just wanna finish with this. I really thank all of you being here because you give me strength. You give other immigrants strength. You give undocumented community strength as well. And this isn't over. I really wish that all of you can get involved and actually make a difference, because together we can make anything happen. Thank you.
That was Jose Diaz, a young undocumented Mexican immigrant. Al Dornan finished the walk back where the group started, outside the Hartford Office of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, and spoke to the group about his commitment.
The people who come to this country today are fleeing from dire poverty. They are fleeing from crime. They are fleeing from despotic governments, which in great measure were brought into power by the misguided foreign policy of our own government. The people today who are now walking through Mexico towards our border, where they will be denied entry into the United States, if necessary, with government troops. This is not right. This needs to change. Not only am I the son of immigrants, I am a dreamer. When I was a young boy growing up in America in the 1940s and the 1950s, I enjoyed the American dream. But I enjoyed the American dream only as a white male American. When I was growing up in this imperfect country, black people were to a great extent still treated as less than human. Women were still treated as baby makers and cooks in the kitchen. That cannot continue. This dream that I enjoyed must be for all people. All people in this world are entitled to the right to have equal opportunity to live a good and wonderful life. And I am saying to you today, please believe me, I am saying to you today that for me, this is only the beginning. I will walk until I am physically unable to walk. A week ago, on last Sunday, a man who I would suspect many of you as South and Central Americans know, Archbishop Oscar Romero, was canonized as a saint in the Catholic Church. But you and I know that he didn't have to be canonized. He was a saint a long time ago. And I am proud that I follow the guidance of Archbishop Oscar Romero. If he could give his life for the people he loved and cared about, then why can't I give my back and my feet dedication to the people I care about? I love you all. Thank you for coming. I will continue.
That was Al Dornan, a fierce 78-year-old supporter of immigrants' rights, preceded by Jose Diaz, a young undocumented Mexican immigrant. Learn more about local grassroots campaigns to protect immigrants' rights by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on eJazz Radio in Kampala, Uganda, WDRT in Viroqua, Wisconsin, KUGS in Bellingham, Washington, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.